Hello, welcome to Mind Chat. My name's Philip Goff. I'm a philosopher who thinks consciousness pervades the universe and is a fundamental feature of it.
Hello, welcome to Mind Chat. My name's Keith Prankish. I'm a philosopher who thinks that consciousness, at least as many philosophers think of it, it doesn't really exist.
And we're overjoyed today to be joined by Professor Noam Chomsky. Welcome to Mind Chat, Professor Chomsky.
Pleased to be with you.
Well, Professor Chomsky needs no introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway, just for form's sake. He is a laureate professor of linguistics at the University of Arizona and an institute professor emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He is a towering figure in the field of linguistics, the creator of several major theoretical programs that have shaped the field. He's also a major figure in cognitive science and analytic philosophy, and he was one of the pioneers of the cognitive revolution of the 1960s. And in addition to his scientific work, he is also a highly influential social critic and political activist who advocates for libertarian socialism. He's the author of more than 150 books, and he's one of the most cited scholars alive. And in addition, he is the only Mind Chat guest who was on Richard Nixon's enemies list. So welcome, Professor Chomsky.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much.
So what we're going to do today, Professor Chomsky's made major contributions in a very wide range of areas. Oh, Keith seems to have disappeared. Hopefully he'll join us again in a moment. So Professor Chomsky's made a wide range of contributions, but on Mind Chat, we're mainly interested in consciousness. So what we're going to do, we're going to ask some questions to explore Professor Chomsky's unique and distinctive perspective on the philosophical and scientific challenges posed by consciousness. And then I'm going to try and persuade Professor Chomsky that consciousness is everywhere. And then Keith's going to try and persuade Professor Chomsky that consciousness is nowhere. And if we have a little bit of time, I can't resist maybe asking a little bit about politics towards the end, but we'll see if we've got time. And maybe we can have some audience, one or two audience questions at the end. Okay, as always, if you like the content of these videos, please do subscribe to the channel and the audio podcast, like the video, write some comments, write us a five-star review, and so on. Thank you very much. Okay, let's start the discussion.
Right. Well, Philip and I, in our different ways, have dedicated much of our lives to trying to solve the philosophical problems surrounding consciousness. But if I understand right, you, Professor Chomsky, think that these problems may be beyond the capacity of human beings to solve, that they're mysteries rather than problems, that our intellectual capacities may be not up to the task. Now, if that's right, if that is your view, then, and that's correct, then, well, that means that Philip and I and many other people have been wasting our time. Is that a fair characterization of your view, a mysterianism about consciousness? And could you tell us a bit more about that, please?
You know, I think we should step back a little bit and ask which questions we're talking about. As far as there is by now a conventional distinction between the easy question and the hard question. I should say that I'm not convinced that the hard question exists. I know there are interrogative statements that seem to formulate a hard question, but something in the form of an interrogative may not be a question. So if I ask, why do things happen, has the form of a question, but it's not a real question because there's no possible answer to it unless a formulated interrogative has possible answers. It's not a question. And that's my feeling about the so-called hard question. So let's take a concrete example. Suppose you ask me, what was it like to see the sunset last night? I can give a detailed answer then. Or if I had the talent, I could give a very detailed answer. But even with my limited talents, I could describe it in detail. That's a real question. On the other hand, if you ask me, what's it like to see a sunset? I have nothing to say at all. There's no answer to that question. So it's not a, it has the form of an interrogative expression, but it's like, why do things happen? It's not a real question. My feeling is that the so-called easy and hard questions pretty much divide along that line. There are questions that you can formulate that have possible answers. You can try to give answers to them. There are formulations you can give that look like questions, but unless there are at least possible answers, they're just expressions that have the form of interrogatives, but not real questions either for science or philosophy. And I'm inclined to think in reading the literature that that's pretty much the division between easy and hard questions. And in writing about this, so I'm not convinced that the questions are mysteries, at least the ones that we can formulate that have possible answers. They seem to me within the range of human science. I think there probably are things that aren't within that range, but I'm not convinced that this is one of them. Another concern I've had about the literature, I've discussed it a little here and there, is that I think it fails to make what seems to me a crucial fact, that what's conscious, let's say conscious decisions and so on, are deeply intermingled with unconscious mental acts, so closely intermingled with them that I don't think you can extract the conscious part and have a coherent picture. I think that's particularly clear, at least in the area of my major concerns, use of language, like take what we're doing now. I'm making a decision to produce a particular sentence. Mm-hmm. I have no awareness of when I decided to make that decision. It just happened. I don't even know what sentence I'm producing until I hear it. So I think there was a decision, but deep in the realm of the unconscious and inaccessible to consciousness. Well, here there are questions we can ask. Can we work out the mental acts that are taking place when we choose to select a sentence? Can we find the areas of the brain that are involved in those activities? In those domains, we can make a degree of progress. In fact, I think there is progress, both in working out the nature of the mental acts and in the discovery of the brain areas that are implicated. Not what the brain areas are doing, that's beyond what we understand, but at least what areas are involved. Well, all of that is the easy question, if you like, but it's one that intermingles conscious and unconscious in such a way that you really can't extricate the conscious fact. In fact, if you try to introspect about what we call, most of your use of language, almost 100%, 99% of it is just internal. Mm-hmm. It's psychologically impossible to empty your mind and not think about something. Maybe Buddhists can do it, but I can't. And when you think about what we call inner speech, thinking to yourself, we discover very quickly it's not inner, it's not internal, it's not the internal workings of the language. It's external speech where you're not using the articulatory system. So it's a peripheral system. What's going on inside is good evidence. We can't speak it to ourselves. It's beyond consciousness. And if we look more closely, you can do the introspection yourself. It seems to me we don't really. Inner speech is not actually sentences. It's little bits of fragments that come to our mind. And it's all done instantaneously. So quickly, you can't imagine how it's done. There's way beyond the speech, the speed of neural transmission, for example. So all kinds of things are happening unconsciously. Little bits and fragments come to consciousness. We can study in the usual way of the sciences indirectly what the mental acts are that are underlying all of this, and to an extent, how the brain is implicated. But beyond that, I just don't see what we can say. I don't know how to formulate questions that have answers. It's roughly the way it looks to me.
Well, that's a perspective that I myself am very sympathetic to. And indeed, I'll maybe say a little bit more about my perspective later. But well, maybe this will be a point that would Philip like to come in there to. You definitely think there are real problems beyond the easy ones.
Maybe when I try and persuade you to be a panpsychist, maybe I could, in line with trying to do that, maybe suggest positive answers to the questions. But what I wanted to ask first, actually, was about dualism. So for those who don't know, dualism is the view that consciousness is non-physical outside of the workings of the body and the brain, maybe in the soul. And the philosopher Gilbert Ryle famously mocked dualism as belief in a ghost in the machine. But I really loved, Professor Chomsky, your twist on this. So you reject dualism, if I understand, but not because you're worried by machines being haunted by ghosts as such, but more, and I quote, your worry is that Newton exercised the machine but left the ghost completely intact. So it's a really cool quote. Could you maybe explain a little bit about what you intended here?
Well, I should say this is quite a heterodox position, so it's my view. If you look at the history of the topic, we're now talking history of science, there was the Galilean, what we call the Galilean Revolution, was based on a fairly clear conception of what physical is. They had a conception of the physical, no distinction between physical, material, body, it's all the same thing. It wasn't precise, but it was reasonably clear, called the mechanical philosophy. Philosophy, of course, meant science in those days. So mechanical science. And the picture was that an intelligible explanation would have to be within the framework of mechanical science. Mechanical science meant something like these artifacts that were being developed all over Europe at the time. Skilled artisans were constructing amazing things that looked real, you know, gardens at Versailles, mechanical clocks, plays, and so on. It's kind of a little bit like what you hear from Silicon Valley today. Are these things really alive, sentient, and so on? But about at the same level. But except we now have a couple hundred years of understanding why this doesn't make any sense. But That was the picture of matter. It was held by just about every serious scientist. Galileo, the founders of the Royal Society, Huygens, Leibniz, Newton, all took this for granted. Descartes, of course. And Descartes' dualism, in my opinion, is kind of misunderstood. It seems to me Descartes' dualism was ordinary science, simple, normal science. He thought he could show that just about everything in the world, including most of human behavior and sensibility, could be accounted for within mechanical science. But he noticed that there were things that couldn't be accounted for this way, and he was basically correct. One of them, which interests me particularly, is what's come to be called the creative aspect of language use. The fact that ordinary, normal language use is unbounded, innovative, creative. You may be, in Cartesian terms, incited and inclined to speak in certain ways, but you're not compelled. He thought this was essential to humans. And the most dramatic case of it was language. This was followed up by the what we call the minor Cartesians. People don't read them, but I think they're very interesting. Now, people like Jacques de Cordemois, who developed a pretty sophisticated version of what's nowadays called the Turing test. He said, if some creature that looks like us can respond appropriately to any question we can put to him, it would only be reasonable to assume that he has this property that goes beyond mechanism. Well, if you have something that goes outside the framework of the set of assumptions you have to postulate a new principle. That's res cogitans. So he says, yes, there's another principle in addition to the mechanical principle. Then you ask, how are they connected? You know, get into this business of the pituitary gland and so on and so forth. But that's all straight science, perfectly reasonable science. Then Newton came along. And if you take a look at the Principia, a lot of it is devoted to showing that Descartes' physical explanations don't work. Newton regarded this as, in his words, absurd. And he said the conclusions he's reaching are totally absurd, but they seem to be true. It's generally assumed by historians of science that Newton called his work Principia Mathematica, not Principles of Philosophy, for the reasons he explained. He said he has no explanation. He has no scientific explanation. That's the context for his famous, I make no hypotheses comment. He says, I have a mathematical theory that describes the facts, but I have no scientific theory. In fact, he spent the rest of his life trying to find some physical basis, what he would call physical basis within mechanical philosophy. Well, where do we end up from this? What happened, I think, is significant. Newton, Leibniz, Huygens, the rest regarded Newton's theories as ridiculous, just as he himself did. They argued he's reinstating occult ideas, the hated ideas of the neo-scholastics. Newton agreed, but he said that his occult ideas were different because he had a mathematical theory. And the mathematical theory was intelligible, like Leibniz understood the theory. Just both he and Newton regarded it as absurd, but they understood it. But I think what happened in the history of science is that the goals were restricted. Instead of trying to find an intelligible world, whatever that is, you look for intelligible theories like Newton's or Laplace, or the developments that came later. And anything is acceptable as long as it's part of a mathematical theory. forces, fields, later more exotic things when you get to quantum mechanics and so on. Whatever you postulate in the best theory, that's all we can say about the body. Well, John Locke understood this very quickly. Immediately after Principia appeared, in a couple of years, he came out with what called Locke's hypothesis, extracting it from its theological framework. It comes down to mean essentially that thinking, anything mental, is just some aspect of organized properties of the brain. I think that's where we are now, that exercised the machine, but it left the ghost intact. Then you go through the 18th century, there's a lot of serious work on this, culminating in Joseph Priestley's work, end of the century, where he tries to develop this in a fair amount of detail. It was then forgotten, literally, and it was revived in the late 20th century with the idea that this radical new idea in philosophy of mind, maybe philosophy is just, maybe mind is just some property of the brain. And if you look at the late 20th century pronouncements, they are almost identical with late 18th century. I mean, there's a hiatus there, which is something to learn from. So going back to Gilbert Ryle, who, of course, I studied when I was a student, I felt right away that there was something wrong. As I learned more about the history of science, I think you can see what it is. It's the opposite of what he said. There's not a ghost in the machine. There's a ghost and there's no machine. The machine is whatever exists in the world. I mean, if it turns out that, say, John Wheeler at the Institute of Advanced Studies suggests the theory that's called it from bit, the only thing that exists are the answers to questions we pose to nature. That's it. Everything else, that's matter. There's nothing else to say about it. Well, I'm not competent to say whether that's right or wrong, but physicists take it seriously, so I presume it's at least plausible. Suppose it turns out to be true, okay, that's what matter is, because we know nothing, and this comes up in the, as all of them, as you both know better than I do, in the consciousness literature, a century ago, Arthur Eddington, Bertrand Russell, and so on, say, we don't know anything about matter, so we have no reason to say that matter isn't conscious. That's actually a extension of what Newton himself said. And since we know nothing about matter, maybe matter's, all matter's alive, so we can't show that it isn't. He didn't accept it, but he said, can't show that it isn't because we don't know what matter is. So contrary to Ryle, matter was exercised. It just is whatever the best theory tells us it is. What you can do. It's at this point, you do enter the domain where you can distinguish possible problems for humans versus mysteries for humans. This is considered an exotic idea, but it's called mysterianism. To me, it ought to be called truism. if we're part of the organic world, not angels, then we'll be like every other organism. Our cognitive capacities will have scope and limits. And in fact, they're closely related. It's the intrinsic properties, our built-in properties, innate properties that determine the scope, but they immediately give limits as soon as you look at them. You see this in the language area, my area. Find impossible languages as soon as you begin to understand what languages are.
That's fascinating. So for you, the problem of consciousness, the hard problem of consciousness is a non-problem because there are no conceivable positive answers. So let me try and persuade you of a positive answer. And I think it's one that connects with a lot of what you've just been talking about, Bertrand Russell, Arthur Eddington. So I think we have a lot in common. I agree with you that we can't articulate the question in the language of physical science. The way I put it, I don't think you can articulate the qualities of our experience, what it's like to see red, for example, those qualities in the purely quantitative language of physical science. And for those, for that reason, I don't think you can give an intelligible explanation of consciousness in the terms of physical science. If you can't even articulate the phenomenon, then you can't explain it. However, I don't think that's the only option, right? So, yes, I think we can't explain consciousness in terms of matter, but I'm optimistic that maybe we can explain matter in terms of consciousness. So the thought would be, if we just postulate at the fundamental level of reality, networks of very simple conscious entities behaving in simple, predictable ways because they have very simple forms of experience, through their interactions, realizing certain mathematical structures. And then the next move would be to identify those mathematical structures with the mathematical structures of physics. So in this way, we get physics out of consciousness. So maybe we can't get consciousness out of physics, but maybe we can get physics out of consciousness. And this links nicely to what you were saying, because I think the reason this is possible is because, as Bertrand Russell pointed out, we don't know what the hell matter is. All we have is this mathematical description. So as long as there's something at the fundamental level of reality that realizes that mathematical structure, maybe networks of conscious entities, we can get physics out of it. So why isn't that a positive answer to the question, a positive solution to the hard problem of consciousness?
Well, that's, if I'm following you correctly, that's basically Russell a century ago, analysis of matter, which to me sounds like a very, very plausible approach, but I'd interpret a little differently. First of all, just a qualification on seeing red. I don't think we can answer the question, what's it like to see red? I can answer the question, what's it like to see this red spot in front of me? That I can answer. But if you say what it's like to see red, I have no idea what the answer could be. It seems to me like one of these non-questions in an interrogative form. And as I said before, I have the suspicion that the easy, hard problem distinction probably lies right there, formulable questions for which there are possible answers, things that look like questions but have no answers, so they're not really questions. Here we're back to Wittgenstein and the fly bottle, I think. But as for Russell, the way I understood what he was saying is this, maybe it's the same as what you're saying. He said the thing we're most confident about is our immediate consciousness. The rest of our intellectual activities are an effort to make some sense out of it, or as inquiring individuals. So yes, in that sense, physics comes from consciousness. We try to construct some conception of the world, best theory we can of the world, which will yield answers to the questions that we can ask about consciousness, not to those that we can't ask. That's where the distinction comes. But then we're down to the so-called easy questions. And in fact, one of the things we discover right away, that our consciousness is misleading us about the world. So you look at the bent stick and the in the water, in a glass of water, okay, your consciousness is misleading you about the world. so that we're confident about our consciousness. It's not telling us what the world is. Go back to my favorite century again, 17th century. Experience conforms to the modes of cognition. Ralph Cudworth, I think an underappreciated philosopher. So we are very confident about it, but we discover in our inquiries that we're confident about the wrong thing. Not, of course, that it's wrong. We do see the bent stake, but it's not what's happening. The actual world is something different, our best theories tell us. But then I don't think it leads us to the conclusion, the pan-second conclusion. Galen Strawson reaches that conclusion by an argument against radical emergence, but I never found that argument very convincing. I take the simple-minded view that I'm conscious, maybe my dog is, but the table in front of me isn't. I can't prove that, but I don't see any argument against
it. Yeah, I actually agree with you about Galen Strawson's argument. Galen Strawson was actually my PhD supervisor, but I'm actually, my first publication was rejecting his argument for panpsychism. So Galen justifies panpsychism from this intuition that you can't get consciousness out of non-consciousness. And so we just need consciousness there from the start. I agree with you that I don't buy that intuition. I don't see why there couldn't be strange properties that aren't consciousness, but somehow make consciousness. So I don't buy the Strawson argument, but I think that my argument for panpsychism, again, is closely connected to things you've just said. I would make more of a simplicity argument. As you said, the only thing we really can be confident of the existence of is consciousness through our immediate awareness of our feelings and experiences. So if we can account for everything we want to account for just with consciousness, then that's the most simple, elegant, parsimonious theory. That's the one we should go for. And I think we can, because physics is purely mathematical. We can simply postulate networks of conscious entities that realize the structures of physics. We can account for physics. And so there's never a need to postulate anything beyond consciousness. So finally, I think I agree with you that maybe the normal way of putting the problem of consciousness is maybe a non-question, where we're trying to explain away consciousness. But to my mind, the Bertrand Russell approach turns the hard problem of consciousness on its head. So instead of trying to explain away consciousness in terms of matter, we try to explain away matter in terms of consciousness. And that looks to me the most simple, parsimonious way of accounting for all the data. And so the theory that's most likely to be true, we can never know for sure. We can't look inside a particle and see whether it's conscious or not, just as I can't look inside your brain and see whether you're conscious or not. But we should give highest credence to the simplest theory that accounts for all the data. And that seems to me panpsychism.
Well, I agree with you that we should look for the simplest theory, but it should be the theory that accounts for the whole range of evidence. And it seems to me when you look at the whole range of evidence, it's a different picture. I'm confident that I'm conscious. The easy, so-called easy question, you can study it and find out what's going on in my brain when I'm conscious, okay? And what's going on in a what's not happening in the table, let's say. Well, that's evidence too. And we want the simplest theory for all of this. And the simplest theory for all of this, I think, comes down to saying, I'm conscious, my table is, and not so sure about my, say, fish or something else, maybe. But that's going to be answered by the theory of what's going on when you actually have consciousness. So if I think we extend the range of the evidence to all that's the scientific work that gives us some indication of what the neural basis is for consciousness, we want the simplest theory that accounts for all of this, and it does distinguish me from the table. Then we want, so I think we end up with a picture that we can work on the easy question, which is of course very hard, and get pretty good answers to lots of aspects of it. Then we can try to develop the simplest theory of all of this. And it seems to me it does make distinctions between me and the table.
Let me have one more try at this. It almost starts, it's almost sounding like now you're saying we do know what matter is, and we know some of it doesn't involve consciousness. But what I take from Bertrand Russell, the analysis of matter, is we have no idea what matter is. All we know is what it does. It's abstract mathematical structure. So therefore, the alternative to panpsychism is just to postulate that the matter outside of brains has some completely unknown nature, that we know not which, as John Locke said. It's just got some completely unknown nature. Whereas, surely, if the only thing we know about matter is that some of it, the stuff in brains, has a consciousness involving nature, matter outside of brains we're completely in the dark about, surely the simplest hypothesis is to suppose the stuff outside of brains has a nature continuous with the stuff inside of brains.
Well, I think that's taking too literally the general statements by Locke and Newton and others. Yes, we don't know what matter is. But then when we investigate, we can develop theories of what the world is like. Those are our best theories. Okay, matter is whatever our best theories tell us it is. Can't be certain about it. It's an empirical inquiry, so you're never going to have certainty. That's science. But we can have theories that look better than others. And when we look into the neural correlates of consciousness, what happens when you're asleep, under drugs, all this kind of stuff, then we can develop the best theory we can of what's going on when we have the experience of consciousness. Then that tells us, distinguishes me from the table. Now, when you say we don't know, have any idea, that means, well, we can't be certain. There could be other things that we don't know about, but that's true of science generally. I don't think it has any special grasp on this particular branch of science. It's just you do the best you can, get the best theory you can that accounts for whatever is around. Well, there is evidence about what's going on in the brain when some creature is or is not conscious. So let's take that to be our best guess for now as to what matter is. You can still say, well, I really don't know. In fact, a friend of mine, quantum theorist, sent me an article in a quantum theory journal a couple months ago, which was a discussion among hotshot quantum theorists about what a particle is. They can't agree. They don't know what a particle is. But that doesn't mean we know nothing. They agree on a lot of the properties of particles. Just don't know. When you try to go deep enough, you end up with, it's kind of like what Richard Feynman said about quantum theory, is we know how to use it, but nobody understands it. And so you go deep enough, you get to a point where you don't understand anymore. But it doesn't mean you know nothing. The path that Russell suggests is from consciousness to what he called a causal theory of the world. Well, he, as you know, he was criticized for that by mathematician Newman. I think Russell gave it up much too quickly because it assumed that there was no phenomenon, there was no perceptual evidence at all. And he doesn't have to assume that. He could say, well, it's at least what Eddington called meter reading. So yes, you're going to have some basis in perception, but then the counter-argument collapses. So I think he could maintain the conception of science giving us a basically causal theory of the world. But that's something, it's not nothing. It's our best guess as to what matter is, what satisfies this causal theory of the world. And then when we include that in the body of evidence for which we're trying to develop the simplest theory, it seems to me it does make a distinction between me and the table or the brain. You can say the brain is whatever matter is. Thinking is some aspect of whatever matter is, as Locke put it. And we don't have any notion of physical anymore. It's just whatever there is. Okay, but that includes the mind, includes consciousness. Some our best theories say the properties of it show up in some areas, not other areas, like in my behavior, but not what the table does.
I'd love to talk about Newman's critique of Russell, but we'll go on. I think I've had my go at trying to persuade you to be a panpsychist. Keith, can you do any better?
Okay, let me have a shot. Let me see if I can persuade Professor Chomsky to be what I call an illusionist. Don't build too much into the term. The general idea is that we're confused about what consciousness is, or at least a lot of philosophers are confused about what consciousness is. That introspection misleads us. I think introspection is as fallible as perception. It's a psychological faculty. It's not got any wonderful magical powers to acquaint us with a special realm of consciousness. It's just another thing the brain does. And I think we it gives us a confused idea of consciousness. We think of consciousness. We talk about what experience is like. It's a common way of talking. We say that pain was horrible, that taste is delicious. We talk about what experience is like, and that induces us to think that we're referring to private mental qualities. What it is likeness as. Qualia, whatever, that are sort of presented to us in a mental realm. So there's say the coffee we're tasting, that has some properties, but then that creates taste qualia in our minds, and we're aware of the taste of the coffee via our awareness of these taste qualia, or these taste qualia accompany our awareness of the coffee. And so it's like a show in a private theater where these properties are presented to the self, and that's consciousness. And these qualities are really strange ones. They're supposed to be intrinsic. They're distinct from all psychological reactions and responses. You could have all the reactions and responses without that particular intrinsic field. The field's an added extra. And they're supposed to be radically private. They exist only for the observing self in the theater. No one else can detect them. And they're ineffable. Can't describe them. They have this unique epistemic status that reveal themselves directly to the self and so on. And once you think of consciousness in that way, then you really have created a hard problem for yourself, an insoluble problem. And you've put consciousness outside the reach of experimental science. There's no way you can do science on private, ineffable, intrinsic properties like that. It's like conceiving of life as some vital spark in addition to all the organic processes. People used to think of life like that, and maybe there are reasons, natural reasons why they thought of life in that way, but we now know it's a bad way to think of it. It's life's just a collection of highly complex organic processes. And so illusionists say, stop thinking of consciousness in that way. Stop creating an insoluble problem for yourself. They say consciousness doesn't involve awareness of private mental qualities. It involves awareness of features of the world and our own reactions to those features of the world. Our awareness of the world is colored by our reactions to it, our psychological reactions to it. And the reason we think there's this private inner show is because of the limited introspective access we have to all those complex psychological reactions. Stimuli impact upon us and they create a host of psychological reactions. And we have a vague sense of this, of there being a sort of internal richness, a richness of a psychological richness, a richness of processes. But we can't articulate this. And so we just gesture at it by talking about what experience is like. And then the mistake is to reify that notion of what it's like into what it is likenesses. And where do these, what are these what it is likenesses? And how does the brain produce them? And maybe they're fundamental features of all reality and so on, as panpsychists say. So it's a kind of illusion. The notion of consciousness that panpsychists and dualists are working with is a bad one based on that arises from the limitations of introspection, and we should discard it. And as you said, simply focus on the easy problems, the problems of explaining what the processes that occur during episodes of experience. So that's roughly the picture. Do you think it misses anything out, I think is the question.
Well, I'm partially sympathetic to that for reasons I mentioned. So in the areas where I mainly work, say language, as I said, I think there's interpenetration of what we're aware of and things we can't be aware of, which play a major role in what we call experience. But it doesn't seem to me that that gives us a reason to cast out one element of the psychological reactions that we have. Namely, I see the color red in the upper left of my visual field, and here's what it looks like. And that seems to be one of the psychological reactions, whatever one wants to call it. I could call it consciousness, call it something else, but it's part of the network of psychological reactions which we constantly have. A good name for it is consciousness, but I don't see how to extricate it from all the others. With that, in that regard, I agree with you, but it doesn't. I don't see any reason, and I think you agree, not to accept it as part of the general network of reactions. Then comes what amounts to a terminological question: are we going to call it consciousness? Well, there's so much weight that's been cast upon the concept of consciousness and the philosophical discussion of mostly this century that maybe we need better terms. Actually, I think it's mostly this century. Until the 20th century, there was very little talk about consciousness except self-consciousness. There was a lot about that, but not. And as I mentioned in one of the papers I sent around, I was always struck by the fact that this contemporary debate seems to exclude the one serious effort to develop a real theory of appearance. Nelson Goodman's, actually I was his student, so I was an undergrad studying with him. At the time, he was working on the book Structure of Appearance, and I don't think it reaches its aims, but it is a serious constructive effort to develop a theory of what appearance is from elementary qualia. So I think it ought to enter into discussion somewhere. But the general point, I think, is yes, we have lots of psychological reactions going on all the time. Some of them fall into what has been called consciousness, like my seeing, people in front of me. As Descartes pointed out, you're not seeing people in front of you, you're seeing spots and lines and so on. We now know a lot more about that. But my consciousness is people, something my mind constructs from data that's coming in. Our best theories tell us something about what the data might be. So I think the picture is attractive, but it doesn't seem to me to lead to the conclusion that we have to excise consciousness and cast it out from the network of psychological reactions.
It's only a certain conception of consciousness.
I just tend to agree with Russell that it's the part that we're most confident about, even though when we look at it, we find out it's not telling us what the world is.
Can I press you on that point about the thing we're most certain of? I mean, in a sense, we can say, yes, this is happening now, whatever it is, and I'm certain this is happening without having any assurance in the way we conceptualize what is happening now. Would you say that our introspective reports and judgments, that they too are constructed by the brain, by the similar sort of processes to the ones in which our perceptual reports and judgments are constructed? And if so, doesn't that mean they have the same possibility of being fallible, distorting, caricatured? I mean, our access to our own minds, to our own consciousness, I mean, that's not magically assured.
Well, I think what our consciousness tells us about the world is fallible and in fact wrong. Mm-hmm. But that's different from saying that the consciousness is fallible. So when I see the bent stick, I see the bent stick. Happens it isn't bent, but that's going back to Russell, when you try to create the best theory you can for what seems to you not fallible. You discover that your own experience is fallible. It's not conforming to the world. As for the fact that it's first person, not third person, I don't know how significant that is. I mean, from a third person point of view, you can get plenty of evidence about when I'm conscious and what I'm conscious about. If we knew enough about the easy question, which we don't, it might be possible by looking at the brain to say he's seeing a red spot in the upper part of the visual field, then from a third person point of view, you wouldn't have the same, you wouldn't be seeing it, but you'd understand what it means to be seeing it. So that would answer all the what it's like questions that can be answered. A lot of them can't be answered, so they're not real questions.
No, I'm totally on board with that. We can be sure of consciousness as a process, that something is happening that is constructing a certain picture of the world for us. I think the question is whether we have some insight into the nature of that process and what it involves, and that it involves, as Dualists and panpsychists think, the presence of some strange qualities, likenesses that are distinctively mental, and that are mental versions of the colors and other qualities we ascribe to things around us in the world. And I think that is going way beyond what we're certain of. I think that's a theoretical interpretation of the process of conscious awareness that leads us down a dead end. We're certainly sure that we're aware of stuff, fallibly aware of stuff. But I don't think that fallible awareness of the world is rooted in an infallible awareness of a private inner world. I think that's just multiplying entities beyond necessity.
I don't think we have to postulate an inner world. We don't need a Cartesian theater. We don't need any of that stuff. All we need is, here's one of my psychological reactions. There's a spot of red up there, and here's what it looks like. Yeah. I can describe it in detail. That's part of my whole psychology. Usual name for that is consciousness. You want a different name? It's okay. But it doesn't tell us about the. I mean, the following Russell's program, the study of the causal structure of the world, tells us the actual world, the one that our best theories tell us about, doesn't conform to my experience, but Cudworth's experience constructed by our modes of cognition. They enter into what the outside world is telling us, and they yield experience, which is it's there, but it's not telling us about the, telling us only indirectly about the world. I think if we sort these things out, we don't have to go into the dead end that you're describing. That's my feeling.
Right. Well, I'm on board with all that. I think, as you say, there are terminological issues, and presentational issues, but the picture you've sketched there seems pretty congenial to me.
So who do you think's more right or less wrong, Professor Chomsky, or are we both totally wrong? Do you think me or Keith is more wrong?
I've written your book with great interest in the article. I think there are ways of reframing them so that they're consistent.
There
you go, Philip.
We've been arguing all this time, Keith, and maybe our views are consistent. Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. Do we have time maybe for a quick question about politics and maybe one or two audience questions?
Sure.
Yeah, so we're supposed to be a consciousness podcast, but I'm very much a political animal, so I can't resist taking the opportunity. You're actually almost exactly 50 years older than me, Professor Chomsky. I was born in the winter of discontent at the end of the 70s that swept Margaret Thatcher into power. So I always think of my lifetime as the time when everything went shit. Because, you know, in the post-war years, we had relatively well-regulated capitalism in the US, Western Europe. High taxes of 80 or 90% on the wealthy in the US and the UK. And, you know, this made, at least in this part of the world, societies more equal and also very high levels of growth. And then from my birth onwards, we've got, you know, the regulation and the taxes slashed, and we've got massive inequality, 2008 meltdown, and
it's all your fault.
I know, the decade of Brexit and Trump and all the rest of it. So I tend to get quite miserable and thinking there's no hope, probably because my existence is coextensive with this terrible neoliberal period. So I wanted to ask, given your broader perspective, living over twice as long as me, whether you have hope that we are perhaps coming to the end of the neoliberal era, and that perhaps there can be some hope that we'll move on to some better economic model. Do you see any grounds for optimism at all?
I have one of the advantages of being in my mid-90s. So I actually experienced this before in childhood. You go back to the 1920s. Pretty similar to today. Thatcher and Reagan have succeeded in driving countries that spread over the world, started in the US and Britain, driving them back to the worst of the 1920s. Extreme inequality, destruction of the labor movement. Notice that both Reagan and Thatcher understood, or their advisors understood, that if you're going to carry out a harsh class war, you've got to eliminate the defenses. people can't be allowed to defend themselves. So their first act was to destroy labor unions, open the door to the corporate sector to go ahead with it. Then comes highway robbery on an extraordinary scale. I mean, in the United States, it's actually been studied. I don't know about Britain. So the Rand Corporation, very respectable corporation, about a year ago came out with a detailed study of what they call the transfer of wealth from the general population to the top 1% during these 40 years of class war, roughly $50 trillion. That's pretty impressive highway robbery. Now, Thatcher's line was, as you recall, there's no society, just individuals in the market. Maybe she believed it, I don't know, but it's total nonsense. There's a very rich society for the wealthy and privileged. Chambers of Commerce, trade associations, business roundtable, even the government, which they mostly run. So they have an enormous support system, and which end up with is what's sometimes been called a bailout economy. The very rich and powerful are protected by a huge network of associations. The rest of the population is tossed out in the market to survive somehow. Well, what do you end up with? $50 trillion of robbery, destruction of democracy, elimination of benefits. I mean, what's going on in England is almost surreal. England had the best health service in the world. NHS was the ideal for the world. They've been trying to turn it into the worst system in the world, the US system, twice the cost of comparable countries, some of the worst outcomes. In fact, the United States is the only country outside of war where mortality is increasing. So, especially the Tory government, but Labour wasn't much different, are saying, let's take the best system, dismantle it, turn it into the worst system. Well, that's class war in a very effective way. Well, let's go back to the 20s. Now, that's what had happened in the United States. Woodrow Wilson's Red Scare had destroyed the pretty vibrant, effective labor movement, silenced critical thought. It was a brutal repression. You get the 20s, a lot of euphoria. I mean, it even spread down to the lower middle class, like my father, an immigrant, you know. He bought some, he got caught up in this real estate speculation when there was all this story about you can become rich by buying real estate. So he bought a particle of land, which turned out to be in the mid-Atlantic somewhere. Okay, that was the 1920s. 1930s, it all changed. Revived, labor movement revived, industrial actions, militant actions, a lot of political activism. By now, we're up to the period I remember. You got the New Deal in the United States, which forged the way to social democracy in the Western world. Okay, why shouldn't that happen again? In fact, we have not bad models for it. You mentioned the regulated capitalism of the 50s and the 60s. It's what economists call the golden age of capitalism. Far from perfect, a ton of things that were wrong. But in comparison with the class war of the last 40 years, it was pretty successful. Well, at the very least, you can go back to that, but then you can go way beyond that. They're much more just, much more free societies. It's a battle, but it's always been a battle. It was a battle in the 1930s. Okay, it is today.
That's great. That's given me lots of grounds for hope. And you know, in many ways, I think, you know, what gives me hope is, I feel in the 2008 crisis, the left was too weak to sort of take advantage of that crisis, as it were, and explain and give us a way forward. But I feel in the decade or so since then, the sort of intellectual infrastructure has built up a lot more. There are a lot of independent news channels and magazines, and there's a lot more going on. It feels like hopefully we can start to articulate a better way forward. But anyway, sorry, I said that would be one question, but that's given me some grounds for help, for hope and help. Maybe just one or two audience questions. If I scroll back a little bit, sorry, we're using new software now. Okay, Digital Gnosis got in first, to a friend of the show, another philosophy podcast, asks, would linguistic reform around consciousness, this reified thing, help us do away these mysterious problems of mind? If so, what linguistic uses in discourse on mind should we encourage? Did you get that, Professor Chomsky?
Afraid not. As some of you don't know, I'm not hearing anything. I'm reading the transcript, and sometimes it doesn't come.
What I could do is put the question in the chat. Can you see the chat? Can you see that?
Okay.
There we go. There's the question.
Would linguistic reform around consciousness, reified thing, help us doing away with these mysterious problems of mind? If so, what linguistic uses in discourse on mind should we encourage? Well, I think there's something to that, as we were discussing. There's been a lot of baggage associated with consciousness in the last couple of decades. And I think my feeling is we can take it apart, reformulate it in simple terms, and eliminate a good deal of what seems to be mysterious. So I think we can say we live in a complex domain of psychological reactions. All sorts of things are going on. A lot of them we're not conscious of, critical to what we do. Something as simple as deciding to produce this sentence and not some other one, totally beyond the level of consciousness. That's true of what we're doing all our lives. We can learn something about it following the path of the so-called easy question, Russell's path, trying to construct the best theory to deal with whatever data we have, some of it. In this network of psychological reactions, there are some that have special properties, like I see a red spot, I have the experience of red up in that corner of my visual field, okay? What's actually happening when you look is there's saccadic eye movements, a little bit of stimuli are being picked up here and there. My mind is doing all kind of complicated things, including interpreting signals to say, and I'm ending up saying, I see a red spot. Well, all of that's going on. We can study all of it. Doesn't change the fact that there are some things that have this property of infallibility. It just puts them in a broader context. As for the dualism, my own feeling is that was cast out centuries ago. We just don't know. We know there are mental, we assume there, actually, even this is a hypothesis. We assume there are mental processes. Remember Gassendi's critique of Descartes, which hit to the center of it and criticized the cogito by saying it doesn't tell you anything about anybody existing, just says thinking's going on. Well, deciding's going on, thinking's going on. In our efforts to make some sense of it, we may postulate a self, but it doesn't mean it's there. It's just all these things going on. We develop our best conception of it. That's the human condition. We can carry out experimental work. We can find what we take to be neural correlates of the things we're looking at, I think we end up with a system that's kind of, if you like, sort of complicated. It's just the way science is. It's the way all the rest of science is.
Okay, maybe one more question. The next question on consciousness came from Katka Skrutova, who's a friend of the show, who says, do you think that language is one of the requirements for consciousness?
I think that language is one of the requirements for consciousness. Well,
yeah,
as you may have noticed, I'm a kind of an old-fashioned conservative, and I believe what was basically proposed by classical Greece, Aristotle, most explicitly classical India, that there's no way of distinguishing language and thought. They're basically the same thing. The language is what constructs thought. Thought, in any sense in which we understand the term, is what's constructed by language. So I don't think language is one of the requirements for consciousness, only in the sense that thought is. If we're not an organism that can propose questions, reflect on them, propose answers, there's no questions to, there's nothing to say about consciousness. We can't even pose a question about it.
Well, thank you very much. We've taken over an hour of your time. It's been absolutely stimulating discussion. We're very grateful to you for taking some time to spend discussing these crucial issues with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. It's been fun to talk to you.
It's been a great session.
Thanks for sending your materials. Very thought-provoking.
Thank you. Well, we'll end the stream. And if you want to hang around for 30 seconds, we could say goodbye off stream. But how we normally finish is to each just draw attention that even though Keith and I and yourself, Professor Chomsky, disagree on many things, one thing we can certainly agree on is that consciousness is wherever it is.
And nowhere else.